Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire, and we've got Dr. Angela Zombeck joining us again this week. She was with us a few weeks ago, obviously, to discuss Fort Taylor and the Civil War. And today we're going to discuss Egmont Key, a place that she's done an incredible amount of research about at the mouth of Tampa Bay, right near Fort DeSoto, a place that many of us often forget when talking about Florida history. So let's get started. Dr. Zombeck, you've spent so much time writing about Civil War history as it relates to Florida, but one really unique thing you've covered is Egmont Key, which is something I was wholly unaware of before I stumbled upon your writing. And honestly, I'd been to Fort DeSoto and didn't think twice about getting on the boat and going to Egmont Key. So take us through that, because that's really fascinating.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think Egmont Key is something that definitely gets a little bit overlooked. It's not that far off of Fort DeSoto, but you do have to access it by ferry. So this is one of those places in the 19th century where, I mean, Florida was truly a frontier, but the United States had the really arguably unique problem of having so much coastline to defend. Like, if we're thinking about this in kind of the context of the age of European empires, they're essentially, at least their mainlands, are landlocked, whereas the United States, after issuing the Monroe Doctrine in 1823, is just surrounded by water. And so Florida gets purchased by the United States in 1821, and then it becomes a question of what do we do to fortify the coast? And at first there's some discussion about actually fortifying Egmont Key, and that part doesn't happen. But after Florida became a state in 1845, then we have a young army engineer by the name of Robert E. Lee, first of all, recommends fortifying Egmont Key. That, like I said, fell through, but the United States government decided to at least construct a lighthouse on the key to guide vessels as they're traveling through the Gulf and then eventually into Tampa Bay, which by that point doesn't have much of a significant population at all. And so in August of 1856, the Congress appropriated $16,000 for a lighthouse. It was open in 1858. And this kind of is unbeknownst to anybody, 3 years before the start of the Civil War. But if we fast forward into the secession of winter of 1860-1861, all of a sudden, Florida secedes, and the Confederate sympathizers in Florida want to make it such that the United States, who is still technically controlling that spot, although I say that very loosely because it's really, quite frankly, up to each individual lighthouse keeper as far as where their sympathies lie. But the goal of the Confederates is to black that lighthouse and other lighthouses throughout the coast of Florida out, so that the United States blockade, part of which was anchored at Key West, could not make use of that lighthouse when they're trying to nab Confederate blockade runners. So in 1861, there was a lighthouse keeper by the name of George H. Richards, who, like many other people on the coast, in that area especially, was essentially an opportunist. If he has a sense that Confederate sympathizers are in the area, then that's where his loyalties are going to lie. If a U.S. blockading ship happens to show up, then he's going to swing that way. But deep down, Richards was more of a Confederate sympathizer than not. And so at one point, when the area was essentially devoid of any Union presence, he, along with members of what was called the Sunny South Guard, which is a pro-Confederate group of civilians, went out to Egmont Key and removed the lighthouse's lamp and oil, and they brought it back to Tampa at Fort Brooke, which is Fort Brooke was where the convention center sits now, just to give you kind of a sense of where that was. But they hid the light in its apparatus so well that it wasn't rediscovered by the United States until the war was actually over. And that allowed the lighthouse to resume operating in June of 1866. So that's kind of the first part of the history of Egmont Key during the Civil War, is that kind of struggle over keeping the lights on, which is, of course, very important for any vessel that's out in the Gulf. Now, as the war goes on, Florida residents, they're few, first of all, but they start really getting pressed by especially the Confederate government and its policies, levying taxes and impressing goods from individuals. And that can happen at the state level and at the national level in the Confederacy. So there's a lot of people who are basically unsettled and who need to start moving in order to survive. And so the other part of the story of Egmont Key during the Civil War is it became a place where refugees went. So at that point, the United States is essentially overseeing the site. I think that might be a better word to use than actually having total possession of it. But individuals realized that if they went out towards that area, they could seek the protection of U.S. blockading vessels. And so into 1862, 1863, and 1864, the number of refugees, both black and white, that go out to Egmont Key starts to increase. It starts off relatively small, around a dozen, and then it will increase from there. And these people, they're men and women, like I said, black and white. They thought that the United States and this location was their best hope for survival. And so they started living in the buildings that surrounded the lighthouse, and they, you know, set up a garden. So they were able to sustain themselves pretty well from that point on, except for in 1864, in several places, including Key West, including Egmont Key, there's a yellow fever epidemic that struck in July. And so when it hit and affected Egmont Key, it killed 16 young men who were both seamen and soldiers. And their ages, I think, are really indicative of, you know, the overall struggle of the war. So they range from 16 to 36. So if you go out to Egmont Key, there's a replica cemetery that's there. The bodies were actually moved to the National Cemetery in St. Augustine. But that cemetery, to see it, is really pretty striking. Because it's a reminder of the toll that the war took. And, you know, we usually think about that as happening on the battlefield. It's not happening on, you know, an island that has Florida's renowned sugar sand surrounding it and is considered a beautiful location. Whereas in the time of the Civil War, it was really someplace that could be pretty deadly.
So you write in one of your pieces on Egmont Key, just this fantastic passage, which kind of encapsulates the whole war experience for Florida residents. You write, "The wartime history of Egmont Key specifically, and that of Florida's Gulf Coast frontier from Key West to Cedar Key generally, are perfect examples of how formal policy and everyday individuals shape the war and the lives of their contemporaries." And I think that that really kind of describes what Florida went through in that period.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a state that is really, in many ways, an afterthought at the time. Unless you're talking about the area of Florida that's, like, let's say, between the northern border and, you know, the Gainesville-Ocala region, where a lot of cotton planters kind of came down in hopes that they could, you know, secure land and participate in that kind of economy. But the farther you go down the peninsula, the sparser the population became, and especially around Tampa. I mean, if we think about the Tampa metro area now, the population is astronomical, and we have, you know, counties like Pinellas that have the highest population density in the state, whereas, you know, during the time of the Civil War, Tampa's population is 300. And they're subject actually to raids that come up being directed from Key West at a couple of points during the war. But the people who are living there, I mean, their loyalties really do truly vacillate. Of course, Florida is part of the Confederacy, but what does that mean when you're on the frontier? So I think the bottom line for people who lived in especially the Tampa Bay area was, what do we have to do to survive?
So Dr. Zombach, of course, you teach at UNC Wilmington. You're an associate professor there. Wilmington, North Carolina, University of North Carolina at Wilmington. I always have to remind myself that people might think we're talking about Wilmington, Delaware, or they might not know what UNC is. Tell our listeners where they can find your other written works.
Right now, I've been for a number of years now working on a book manuscript, the title of which is Stronghold of the Union, Key West Under Martial Law. I'm right now at the stage where I have a full draft and it is being revised. And so I hope to have it back to the press. It'll be published by the University of Florida Press. So I hope to have it back to the press by the end of the summer of 2024. And it should then be in print in 2025. Otherwise, in the midst of all this, I've written several blog posts, some of which were for the American Battlefield Trust and the outlet Emerging Civil War. So I've gotten the word about Key West and the Civil War out there. There's also a forthcoming article that I have for the Journal of Military History that looks at the occupation of Key West and Fort Jefferson in the Tortugas and what the experience of being on occupation duty was like for Union soldiers.
Thank you for that, Dr. Zombach. And you'll be back with us next week as we discuss Key West during the Civil War, a very, very, very important location in terms of Union war planning, as we talked about a little bit during the Fort Taylor episode, and a critical piece to the war strategy of General Winfield Scott and the Union commanders in Washington, D.C. during the war.